Before that, here's Thinking Aloud with Laurie Taylor.
Hello. Well, my friend Tom could hardly wait to tell me about his latest telephonic wheeze. He told me that he'd rung up one of the several numbers which are available on the internet for rail inquiries. And when he got through, he explained he wanted to travel from London to Liverpool on the following Thursday afternoon. Well, after he'd been told the available trains, he began his carefully prepared routine. Well, I don't really want to go all the way to Liverpool, he told the man at the call centre. You see, I've got an appointment in Birmingham. Do you know if the train stops there? There was a moment's silence before he was politely told that Birmingham didn't appear on the train's timetable. Well, in that case, said Tom, would I be able to walk from Liverpool to Birmingham, or would I need to take another train? As soon as he heard the hesitation at the other end of the line, Tom knew he was onto a good thing. He pressed ahead. Or perhaps, he persisted, it might be better to get off at Milton Keynes and take a canal barge to Lichfield. What do you advise? What happened, I asked. He made an excuse and rang off, said Tom. What else do you expect someone from Bangalore to do when they're asked about the waterways of Buckinghamshire? Well, at the time, I did laugh along, but I couldn't suppress a feeling of sympathy for the man at the Indian call centre. I mean, how did it feel for him to have to speak in an assumed English accent and pretend to a knowledge of a country he'd never visited just in order to earn his daily crust? Well, I now know the answers to these questions and to many more, which perhaps had never occurred to me. And they're all to be found in a new book, which is called Dead Ringers. Outsourcing is Changing the Way Indians Understand Themselves. And the author is Shehzad Nadeem, who's an assistant professor of sociology at the City University of New York, from where he now joins me on the line. And also with me in London, I have Henrietta Moore, professor of social anthropology at the University of Cambridge. Shehzad, the title, Dead Ringers. Why Dead Ringers?
Well, I wanted to look at the lived experience of outsourcing. And when I started doing that, when I started thinking about and talking to workers, I started to really get into understanding the way that they were being made to copy the Americans and the English people that they were replacing. So Dead Ringer itself, you know, is a term that refers to one who strongly resembles another. So, you know, in its original meaning, a ringer is a fast horse that's entered furtively into a competition in place of a slower, injured one. Here you're seeing workers in the global south being substituted for their more expensive counterparts in the global north.
Now, we want to talk specifically, I know a little bit later on, about the call centers and their nature, but just to talk a little tiny bit about outsourcing, because outsourcing of Western businesses to India and elsewhere has been going on for quite a long time now. I think it, first of all, probably began with manufacturing. Can you just go through how many varieties of work can be moved abroad? What sorts of work?
Well, seemingly the range is almost infinite in terms of what sorts of work can actually be moved, because that's only really limited by technology and, you know, things like that, but also by the decision-making on the part of corporations as to what sorts of work should be moved. And generally what you're seeing now is you're seeing sort of an expanded range of service work, white-collar work being moved to India and elsewhere. So, you know, we read in the paper that, you know, Indian radiologists are, you know, reading CT scans and x-rays, that Indians are processing tax forms and mortgages, they're burnishing PowerPoint presentations, they're drafting patents and contracts from, you know, from legal offices and so on. But the bulk of the work right now remains, at least the bulk of the work being outsourced to India, the service work, tends to be sort of the lower echelon of white-collar work. So you're talking about, you know, in IT, this would be basic software coding. And, you know, another example, obviously, is the call center work, right, where it's sort of slices of service work. And this is work that's mostly standardized, that's replicable. As one manager put it to me, an Indian manager said, this is the dog work that we outsource.
Let me turn to you, Henrietta. I mean, you've done a great deal of work on globalization. Shehzad is painting a picture of outsourcing which seems mainly driven by Western interest. Does this chime with the picture of globalization as you know it?
Well, I think the picture of contemporary globalization is actually very complicated. We have to keep in mind that there are some Indian companies who are taking over UK companies, for example. So we mustn't always imagine that globalization starts somewhere either in America and Europe and moves towards India and China. because what's happening now is that the phase of globalization we're in, India and China are actually initiators rather than those people who are simply responding to something that's already happening to them.
And I mean, I also understand that there's quite a bit of high-end technology, as it were, that's being carried out in India, that are not just simply the call center, not the dog work being described by Shehzad as well.
Well, yes, absolutely. And of course, in areas like science, stem cell research, and perhaps other areas of sort of synthetic biology, what we might think of as very high-end engineering, this is work that's being done in China and India, and in fact very often there are laboratories in Europe and America who rather wish that they were doing it.
Now, Shehzad, your study, I suppose you could almost describe it as an ethnographic study of these particular workers, these dog workers, you describe them, and you talk about the where they actually work, these self-contained compounds. Describe those to me in a bit more detail.
Well, to give you an example of one of them, there's this place called Mind Space, in northern Bombay. And what it is it's this big sort of compound, you know, high wall security and so on. And inside you have, you know, 17 or 18 apartment towers, you know, call things like quiescent and whispering heights. and then you have many offices, of course, you know, the call centers, and then a lot of IT and software offices and so on. And then inside you have restaurants. And you'll find that mix, right? You'll have sort of a local Indian eatery, but then you'll have Ruby Tuesdays and TGI Fridays.
So, I mean, these people then are really cut off from their families in many ways, from traditional ideas, values, and perhaps from their parents' religion as well, living in a different world.
Yeah, in the night shift, most of these workers, obviously, to serve the UK and the American market, they have to work the night shift and on a permanent basis. And so this means that socially, they hang out with similar people that they work with, right? So they end up a little bit out of step with sort of the ordinary rhythms of the society. So they end up, you know, going out and partying a lot. They end up, you know, sort of operating in a different sphere, in a sense. And so their expectations, their hopes, and their desires tend to be reinforced socially among their peers.
Henriette, I mean, this just sounds almost like modern working practices shifting traditional ways of family life in India.
Yes, I think that's true to a certain extent, but it's also perhaps mostly because these people are cut off from life itself. They're sort of living in a bubble and having to respond in terms of the timing of their work and the way that they're thinking and everything they're doing to what's actually going on in America. But I think if you look at the work that Shehzad has done and others too, what you see is that you get rather a complicated picture, because on the one hand you have a young woman who says, oh, I can't get married because people say that I work at night and I must be up to something, and there are questions about, you know, drinking and sex and, you know, things that you shouldn't be up to. But on the other hand, you can see it from a different point of view, because some of the research shows that some of these young women are suddenly in a position where they are wage earners. And as they become wage earners, their ability to negotiate what goes on within the family increases. So their position is improved.
It isn't just because you point out that these predominantly almost middle-class Indians earning on average a better salary than national counterparts, but when you look at the work conditions, the time pressures under which they work, it doesn't seem quite such a good deal. Tell me a little bit about those time pressures.
Yeah, and this is sort of the problem with what's been happening, is that the work pace and surveillance are rather intense in call centers in particular. And what this means is that you have sort of a tailorization of information work, in a sense. So everything that, you know, a worker does on the line is recorded in most call centers, and managers, you know, can review it and so on. And everything they do is timed. So if you go to the bathroom, you know, that's timed. And if you spend too long in the bathroom, then, you know, you're issued a sort of citation, in a sense. And I spoke to one worker who ended up quitting because she was sort of sick of this constant surveillance. As another worker put it, they record every damn thing. So there's that, and there's a whole host of sort of performance parameters that Indian workers are expected to adhere to, and this can be, you know, stuff to do with accents and things like that, and it can also mean the use of buzzwords, fantastic, you're going to a funeral, fantastic, you know, things like that, and so the time pressures become rather intense, and they end up taking more calls on average than people in the UK and Americans. So that's part of the sort of the underside of the situation. And it's kind of an unnecessary underside,
I mean, there's a lot thing here, because we're talking about the middle classes here, Henriette, yes. working in these places. But from what we are hearing from Josette about the conditions under which they work, it hardly seems really rather like a sort of standard middle class job in many ways.
No, and it's, I think, rather interesting from the point of view of sort of social science, if you like. The situation rather confuses our class categories. We're not really very sure whether these people are properly middle class or whether they are, in a sense, a sort of proletariat doing a sort of technologized job. So their conditions of work are much more like a sort of Dickensian clerk, who, of course, would have been under extreme surveillance, would definitely have worked very long hours, would have weighed very little money, and would have had very little time to spend with family or with anyone else.
Well, we talked about some of the conditions. We've talked about some of the sweatshop conditions, people working in different time zones as well. But let's just hear something about, because we're talking about mimicry and the necessity of taking on another identity. Let's hear something about the actual training about what Indian call centre workers need to know.
We'll just move on to a little bit about the food and drink. Very popular is the fish and chips. You get it at every stall, every second place. If you ask for fish and chips, it's readily available. The popular English dishes include Yorkshire pudding, steak and kidney pie.
But we learnt all the things like the festivals and the history, and we basically learn enough so that, I'll give you an example, if you're in a call, you're sitting in India and taking a call and somebody cracks something about, say, Guy Fawkes Day or something like that. I mean, you should know what it's about so that you can at least understand and say something back to the customer.
Britain is a great country. People are very helpful and caring. They are good people. Gentlemen.
They're very, very polite. Their way of talking is completely different from an Indian, because Indians are very direct.
Some joker who is a quicker will rob you in your liquor if you fail to lock your liquor with a lock.
If Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled peppers, how many pickled peppers?
Shazad, I mean, this just seemed really a very almost demeaning procedure. I mean, I think that what we learned, that came from an edition of Radio 4's Learning Curve back in 2005. But I just wondered what the attitude of Indians is about being invited to don these Western identities. I mean, in some cases, almost to assume false names as well.
Yeah, they're often assume false names and sometimes false locations. And what you often have is some workers are rather enthusiastic about it. I met this one fellow who went by the name Sean. And, you know, he had taken the accent training classes, what they call accent neutralization courses, that are intended to reduce and to eliminate one's, quote-unquote, mother tongue influence. And so Sean had, you know, he spoke with this kind of tortured, Americanized twang. And he said that, I said, what is your name? He said, Sean. I said, inside the workplace and outside? He said, yeah, all my friends and family, they call me Sean. And I look over to his brother, who also worked at the call center. And he gave me a very solemn, meaningful nod, like, yes, we call our brother Sean. So there is a certain enthusiasm among some workers. Others are a little bit more less enthusiastic, in part because of the surveillance I was hinting at earlier. Plato once said that an actor's mask is apt to become his face. These sort of surveillance technologies, what they do is they ensure that the mask is not allowed to slip.
And surveillance technologies, which I noticed, actually include an analysis of wave patterns of speech, so you can see whether people are assuming the proper levels of happiness. I mean, Henriette, it's odd. I mean, the suggestion is here that almost these roles are readily embraced.
Well, I think they are to a certain extent, but I think mimicry is one of the most extraordinary human capacities. I mean, the way we all do it anyway, if you smile at me, I'll smile back at you, unless I'm feeling particularly grumpy. And it's a very important way of learning, of identifying with people. And so it's something which actually we quite enjoy doing anyway, this process. And we particularly like, in many cases, taking on nicknames. You know, where I worked in northern Kenya, some man, actually, his nickname was World Bank. and what that shows you is that there's always in mimicry, there's always just a little bit of menace underlying it. Because when you mimic, it's actually you make something new. You don't make the same. You make something that's not quite the same. So that little bit of distance can give people enormous amounts of enjoyment and satisfaction. And they can exploit it for all kinds of kinds of reason.
It's interesting, just to come to the last point to Shehzad about the future of this, because I suppose we're rather used to reading in newspapers here about various companies like PowerGen, Abbey and Orange, I believe, have closed some or all of their Indian call centres, and surveys show that people don't want to, they want the call to actually fail if they suspect the employees in India. What is the future? How's it going at the moment? Is there some sort of, is there a reduction in the number of call centres being used?
Well, there is, you know, a degree of precariousness that characterizes the global industry in a sense. And so what you're seeing to some degree is some of the work is moving from India to, say, the Philippines and other places where you have, you know, cultural matches in a sense where things aren't too distant. But by and large, you're still seeing companies wanting to push for, you know, sending the work abroad because it's so much cheaper. So if wages keep rising, say, in India, and you continue to experience a labor shortage, then companies might reconsider, you know, where to send the work. But the push is really to continue sending the work.
Okay, thank you very much, Shehzad Nadeem and Henrietta Moore. By the way, just because, I mean, it sounded as though we were really talking about complaints, I just came across this little entry on a blog where someone said, give me a well-educated, articulate, intelligent person in Mumbai over an intellectually subnormal, whining dullard in the UK any day, please. People who have a problem with different accents are narrow-minded xenophobes. Just thought we ought to add that in.